From the halls of every school in Michigan, this is School Talks on 760 WJR with Dr. Robert Livernoy. Sponsored by Wakely Associates, Plant Moran, Real Point, Collins and Plaha, O'Reilly Rancilio PC Attorneys at Law, Clark Construction, and by Must Construction Careers. Now, take your seats. Class is in session. Here's Robert.
This week's edition of School Talks is coming to you from the offices of Collins and Plaha, one of School Talks' primary sponsors. We have a great lineup for you today. We'll be joined by attorneys Gary Collins and Bill Plaha, along with attorneys on staff John Cava, Julia Melkich, and Amber Brennan. We'll also hear from Rich Macheski, superintendent of Troy School District, on some of the great work they're doing. All this and more coming up. This is School Talks on 760 WJR.
This is School Talks on WJR with Dr. Robert Livernoy.
Joining us now on the program, we have attorney Gary Collins from Collins and Plaha, one of School Talks' primary sponsors. And joining us is Superintendent Rich Macheski from Troy School District. Welcome to the program, gentlemen.
Thank you, Dr. Livernoy.
Thank you.
So I'm intrigued at the discussion we're going to have with regard to Troy School's partnership with the Kiwanis Foundation and what it does ultimately for children and in many respects probably gives back to the community in more ways than you can count. And so, Rich, tell us a little bit about the partnership and what it does for kids in Troy.
Sure. Well, the Troy School District has been benefited from being a part of the Troy Kiwanis for many, many decades, and I'm pleased to be a member of that group now myself. Specifically, Kiwanis came and said, how can we help students in the Troy School District? And they had money that they wanted to spend. That is their primary focus of the organization, is to spend money on kids and help support kids. So we worked with them to connect students with healthcare providers. And then Kiwanis, in turn, helps provide the funding to support needy families and their students.
So you really are the conduit between the family and a healthcare provider. Is this primarily in the mental health, or is it physical, or what types of supports?
Excellent, excellent question. Yeah, it's mainly mental health. That's what we find more often than not. Students that come to, whether it be a teacher, a trusted adult, their counselor more often than not, are struggling with whether it be depression, some level of anxiety, just challenges that they're having with school. So most of those are around that mental health area.
And the funding for this partnership comes exclusively from Kiwanis, correct?
That is correct.
So, Gary Collins, tell us a little bit about what was your role in helping the school district sort of pull this together and do it the right way?
Sure. What the firm has to take a look at when you look at public-private partnerships is to ensure that you have the confidentiality of the individuals in the school districts as well as the confidentiality of the private sector people who are addressing. And so while you can have a helping find partners, the actual counseling, the actual type of counseling, all of that has to remain private and has to remain confidential, or you're going to defeat the confidence that you need to have from the parents and the students. The other type of thing you take a look at is making sure that there is not liability on either side, either on the school district side or the Kiwanis side. So you have to coordinate with your insurance policies to make sure that it's going to be covered, that we're not going to have any activity that's going to come back and provide liability to the Troy School District for actually just helping students.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because any good intention could have a bad outcome.
Totally.
Especially if it doesn't go the way you anticipated. So, Rich, tell us a little bit about what role do your school counselors play in sort of making this connection?
Well, school counselors are vital in this particular role because they're oftentimes the first individual to come in contact with a student, recognize that the student needs some level of support, and they also understand that in many cases families can't afford, to the point that you made earlier, they can't afford to get that service. They may not have insurances and so forth. So what they can do is create an intake And they can determine whether a family would qualify for this additional service. And their role is to then connect the family directly to a service provider. And in turn, then Kiwanis pays the service provider for the work that they've done.
So that was an important question I had, is how does the money actually move from Kiwanis? So it really doesn't flow through the school district.
That's correct.
That seems like a smart legal strategy.
Yes, it is, Dr. Lerner.
And it makes sense, because you really want it to be between the family and their provider.
Correct. Right.
What a great opportunity for the school district to be a conduit for something arguably that matters just about more than anything right now in schools. We're currently with Gary Collins from Collins and Blaha and Superintendent Rich Macheski from Troy Schools talking about a wonderful partnership with the Troy Kiwanis Foundation and Troy Schools. I want to expand a little bit on the role of your counselors. For anyone that's connected to schools, they have an appreciation, I think, that others don't, as to what children bring to school every day with them. That often is their only place of refuge or their only place of safety in some respects. And your counselors, are your counselors K-12 in the mix of providing the support for the Kiwanis opportunity?
So right now, our counselors are at middle school and high school only. At the elementary level, we have social workers. So we have been able to add social work support to the elementary. So both social work, psychologists, any itinerant staff, as well as counselors, can connect a family to a service provider where the Kiwanis would then have the opportunity to support them financially.
Yeah, so this is this question either for you, Gary, or Rich. Do you know whether Kiwanis on a larger scale is doing this anywhere else?
To my knowledge, no.
Yeah, I would agree, Gary. To my knowledge, they're not doing this anywhere else. They came to us with a unique problem. They had some extra money that they wanted to spend, and they only wanted it to spend it on helping students. And they engaged the school district in a conversation around how best they could do that. And given mental wellness for our young people is such a challenge today, yeah. We felt that this was a great opportunity to explore.
What a fantastic opportunity. One last follow-up question on the counseling front. Are your counselors using any particular screening tools to determine whether a student might be the right fit for this opportunity?
Yes, we actually came up with a screening tool in conjunction with Gary's associates' help. We brought together some screening tools that were being used elsewhere and found one that worked best for us. It's an intake form, not more than just gathering information about the needs of the particular student, but also there's some financial questions that are being asked there. Is this a family that would require services that maybe, for instance, insurance isn't otherwise covering? So is there a need? Because this really needs to be need-based, to be knowing that we have families that have access to healthcare in other places, recognizing that there's others that don't. We really wanted to make sure those were the families able to take advantage.
Sure, and although the program's in its infancy, have you received any feedback from parents or the community, given how much of a force Troy Kiwanis is?
Well, I just last week had the opportunity to talk with one of our lead counselors who's been involved in helping to push this initiative through, and she just thanked me and said that she's already received feedback from a couple of families that are scheduled to take advantage of the program. So timing was perfect with respect to this program, and I know that our community is going to greatly benefit from participating.
What a perfect example of the phrase, it takes a village to raise a child. I appreciate the work you're doing there, Superintendent Rich Macheski and Attorney Gary Collins, for a great opportunity to discuss the Troy Kiwanis Foundation and this growing opportunity for children in Troy. Thanks very much for being on the program.
Thank you, Dr.
Thank
Lamar.
You.
Coming up after the break, we'll hear from attorneys Bill Blaha and Julia Melkich. Stay right there. We'll be back right after this.
This is School Talks on WJR with Dr. Robert Livernoy, sponsored by Wakely Associates, Plant Moran, Real Point, Collins and Blaha, O'Reilly Rancilio PC Attorneys at Law, Clark Construction, and by Must Construction Careers. Once again, at the head of the class, Dr. Livernoy.
In our continuing conversation here at the offices of Collins and Blaha, one of School Talk's primary sponsors, we're joined by partner Bill Blaha and attorney Julia Melkich talking about public education and its history. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Dr. Livernoy.
Thank you.
So, Bill, given all the attention currently focused on the Federal Department of Education, there's a lot of chatter about what is going to happen to it and what the implications are. I think it's an opportunity for our School Talks listeners to just stop and really understand what is the purpose of public education.
I would characterize the purpose of public education from its origin to spread knowledge amongst the masses and not have it concentrated in a few like the king, so that we can have a more informed citizenry, to have a more perfect union in the context of a democracy. So the free and appropriate education concept, regardless of race, disability, socioeconomic status, and various other factors, is allowing equal access to public education in this country. And it has served the country well, notwithstanding the United States Department of Education that was formed in 1979 in the Jimmy Carter era, and now in a phase of dissolution, or arguments about dissolution. But that constant purpose still remains.
And you know, you mentioned the basically education for all. And when I think about, you know, America being one of the most powerful countries in the world, if not the most powerful for a number of reasons, whether it's the consumption of goods or whatnot, I would consistently argue that one of the things that levels the playing field is that everyone gets an opportunity at an education. Maybe some better than others, but there is this leveling that is offered through public education that really is I would say unique in many respects. And I know there's been a lot of discussion over the years as to where America compares with other nations and so on, and that debate could go on for a while. But the one thing I want to touch on that you mentioned that I think is an important reinforcement, and that really is the notion of a democracy in action. And for our School Talks listeners, in Michigan, local school districts are municipal corporations. Just like a city or a township might be, they have a locally elected school board, they have an amount of local control over their budgets, and they enjoy a fair amount of autonomy. And I think the long-standing battle over the last 20 or 30 years is, where does that autonomy shift? Where does the centralization of power move between the state level and the local level? And not necessarily just for money, whether it's curriculum or ideology and whatnot, but at its base, the idea that the schools are available for all is really, to your point, the purpose of a public education. So, Julia Melkich, let me ask you, any major events that you could point to in our nation's history that really articulate some of these things we're talking about with regard to public education?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think it's very interesting just to remember that when the first public school opened, or the first few public schools opened, you know, there was a large focus on religion. And at first, the belief was that we need to get children into school and they can learn how to read, and therefore they could read the Bible and avoid corruption and things like that. And so that continued through the 1600s and the 1700s. And during that time period, the state started to enact compulsory education laws requiring kids to go to school so they could become literate and continue their religious studies. Also during that time period, especially in the late 1800s, this was really reinforced by the United States Supreme Court, we kept schools segregated. So it wasn't really free public education for all. We had the Supreme Court decision in Plessy v. Ferguson that reinforced the doctrine of separate but equal, essentially legalizing segregation at that time. We also had forced schooling of Native Americans, where they were required to attend a boarding school to learn English and assimilate into American culture and attend church while they were there.
And these examples you're pointing to, they sort of are part of some of the most difficult chapters in American history. And the evolution of it leads up to a point. Could you tell us a little bit about where prayer actually ended in public schools?
Absolutely. We saw a big shift in the 1950s. So at that time, World War II was ending, and the federal government began implementing or enacting laws that would provide additional federal funding for schools. So at that time, the federal government had very limited involvement up until about the late 50s. And then to your question about religion specifically, in 1962 and 1963, we had cases from the United States Supreme Court prohibiting reading the Bible in school and then organized prayer in public schools.
And what particular particular part of the Constitution reinforced that you can't read the Bible in school? What amendment or part of that?
So the Supreme Court holding was based on the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment, and that deals with no government establishment of religion.
So, Bill, could you capture for our School Talks listeners some of the big moments in education over the last several decades?
Starting with the Reagan administration, there was a commissioned publication, it's called A Nation at Risk, that analyzed public education, its curriculum, the comparison with other countries, and a concern that our public education was falling behind and letting our kids down, and more needed to be done. And in subsequent administrations, such as the second George Bush administration, was the No Child Left Behind Act to ensure safer schools and ensure that every child can read by the third grade and require testing. That was an effort to improve education. Of course, internet in early 2000, fortunately, was in all U.S. schools. And then in the Obama administration, there was an effort to improve education nationally, where you pretty much hands-off for the most part through history, was an incentivized program for states to come up with reforms for public education in exchange for federal funding. And in Michigan, by 2010-2011, pursuant to the Race to the Top incentives, Michigan had massive change of reforms that included bargaining changes with the unions that tilted favor back in pro-school board. There were changes in the Engler administrations and the Granholm administrations that resulted in more centralized control over curriculum and less local control. So throughout all these years, when you say and as you mentioned at the outset, there's been a lot of policymakers tinkering with what they think is appropriate for education. And in the end, despite all these policy changes and the differences and impositions made, it really has been one constant in public education. In my 40 years of practicing school law and working with numerous school districts in the state, is that the constant is dedicated educators, elected school officials with their hearts in the right place, local support staff, all those dedicated individuals, notwithstanding what's going on at the state and federal levels, continue to service children that are our next generation of leaders in the public and private sectors.
I appreciate your time, Bill and Julia, for a great conversation on a nice look at public education and what it really means, and we'll see where it goes. I appreciate it very much.
Thanks
for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up after a word from our sponsors, we'll hear from attorney Amber Brennan. This is 760 WJR.
School Talks on WJR with Dr. Robert Livernoy.
Joining us now in the program is Amber Brennan from Collins & Blaha Law Firm, one of the attorneys on staff here. And our conversation today centers around Title IX, a pretty, I would say at times, a controversial issue in both federal law and how it plays down into state law, especially how it affects school districts. And welcome to the program, Amber.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So let's start off first. What is Title IX?
So Title IX, as we know it today, and what Title IX specifically says, it's Title IX of the Education Amendment Act of 1972, and it says no person in the United States shall, on the basis of sex, be excluded from, be denied the benefits of, or be subjected to discrimination under any education, program, or activity if that educational institution is receiving federal funding. And that's all prohibited on the basis of sex.
And the Title IX law, as we know it, it applies to all public and private schools who receive federal money, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So, you know, when you think about, in my time as superintendent, for the length of time I was superintendent, obviously I was in that role through many different federal level organizations, presidents, and so on. And there seems to be, at least on its face, the factor that whoever is in power federally often, at least to some extent, controls sort of the political winds of how Title IX is interpreted and or applied. I can think back to when President Obama was in office and how Title IX was imposed on schools versus during, say, Donald Trump's first term, how the ebb and flow of it. Talk a little bit about how that range of movement in Title IX happens given the type of legislation it is.
I agree with you. I do think it's a very political topic, depending who is the president at the moment, what administration is in, and we've definitely seen that since the Obama administration in 2011. And I think Title IX is one of those things that has evolved and it keeps evolving, keeps us on our toes, and it's been doing that for 50 years. But to really understand it, going back to the birth of Title IX and how it came about today, it started in 1965, actually, not 1972. And it was with the Higher Education Act. And that Congress enacted that to strengthen educational resources for colleges and universities. And then in 1972, that's when Congress enacted what we know today to be Title IX. And when it first came about, people didn't know yet if it was just academics and athletics. And it kept evolving through the courts and through the Department of Education. Initially, we didn't know if people had a private right of action. And then that went through the courts. And then they said yes. And then we were unsure at that point in time if you could get monetary damages for it. And so that was all the late 80s and the 90s. And then 1999, with the famous U.S. Supreme Court case of the Davis case, that is when it was determined you could have peer-on-peer sexual harassment. So it's just been evolving throughout the years, throughout the decades, and then to come forward to 2011 with the Obama administration. Prior to that, it was always guidance documents that we had and court cases that we had to go by. But what was dynamic about that is that that was the first time that a Dear Colleague letter came out, and the Obama administration said it had the force and effect of law, but they didn't go through the process of making it a law. And they set forth this federally mandated investigation process at that time, which just caused everyone to scurry and kind of go into a panic and mm-hmm. created a lot of anxiety, because it did apply to all educational institutions receiving federal funding, especially K-12, and they mm-hmm. weren't prepared for all of that. And then when the Trump administration first started in 2017, that was when we heard that they were going to go through the rulemaking process. And then we heard the 2020 Title IX regulations came into play, and they did go through that process. Mm-hmm.
Let me ask one clarifying question for our School Talks listeners. You said the Supreme Court agreed that there is a private right of action under Title IX. Tell us what that means.
So meaning that a student, for instance, if they are sexually harassed while at school, while they're in a school program or activity, that they have the ability to bring forth a private right of action for monetary damages for what happened to them at school. And if the district is not taking appropriate action to stop it, to correct it, to prevent it once they have notice, then potentially a school could be liable for that.
Talk a little bit about how this final rule has created another something else for you to do as an attorney in helping school districts navigate that.
Right, and that's a great question, and we always try to make this distinction with our clients because Title IX was always about sex discrimination. So whether it's academics, athletics, school buildings, or sexual harassment, it all falls under the umbrella of Title IX. But what the 2020 regs did was set forth this specific investigation process for sexual harassment. And if it's not sexual harassment, then you don't have to follow this rigid, federally mandated investigation process. That's one of the big distinctions between how it was pre-2020 and when those regulations came into play.
So in layman's terms, if it's not labeled as such, then all of the expectations of the law don't apply.
You still would have an obligation to investigate and to correct discrimination, but you wouldn't have to go through this rigid process of written notice letters and doing an investigation a certain way and giving both parties the opportunity to see the evidence, for instance, and opportunity to respond. And then they actually can see the draft investigation reports before they're done.
And, you know, in this continued spirit of ebb and flow, we're talking about the 2020 regulations.
Correct.
And as I understand it, there was now a 2024 final rule that I think in some ways either extended or changed the interpretation of this and in many respects created a new set of obligations for school districts to follow, or at least the revision of some. Can you tell us a bit about the 2024 final rule?
Yes. Yeah, so the couple of takeaways from the 2024 regs, number one, it broadened the scope of what sex discrimination was. So what 2024 did was it included sex stereotypes, sex characteristics, sexual orientation, gender identity. It specifically named pregnancy and related conditions as falling under sex discrimination. So those would be all broadened categories of Title IX.
Any litigation or anything still remaining from the 2024 rule?
Not remaining. What happened most recently and what people are hearing about is the 2024 regs are no longer a thing, basically. The courts did say that they basically don't exist anymore. They vacated the 2024 regs as if they never existed.
Amber Brennan, attorney here at Collins & Blaha. I appreciate the conversation today about Title IX and keep up the good work.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
After the break, we'll continue our conversation here at the offices of Collins & Blaha with attorney John Cava. Stay right there. We'll be back right after this.
Talks on WJR is sponsored by Wakely Associates, Plant Moran, Real Point, Collins & Blaha, O'Reilly Rancilio PC Attorneys at Law, Clark Construction, and by Must Construction Careers. Now let's get back to class. Once again, your host, former Superintendent Dr. Robert Livernoy.
Continuing our program here from the offices of Collins & Blaha, we're joined by attorney John Cava to talk about school districts and all the resources available for parents that many may not be aware of. Welcome to the program, John.
Thank you. Glad to be here today.
I appreciate that. So, as we all know well, Michigan school districts have an enormous amount of information and resources available for parents in the education of their children. It is no secret on any number of fronts. And from your perspective and some of the work you've done legally and whatnot, what are some of the big, say, bucket things that are available for parents that could help them navigate their child's education?
Yeah, so working with school districts, as I've come to be both as an attorney, but now as a parent with young kids that are in a public school district, realizing that there's so much out there. And so there's school district websites that have a plethora of information that includes sites for parents and resources for parents. There's also board policies on those websites. And then there are student and parent handbooks specific to various questions that may come up, such as what is the dress code for this particular school? And then finally, there's laws that, you know, we're all confined by in the public sector and public school setting. And parents, you know, can help in the education of their kids if they are more aware of those laws.
Mm-hmm. So let's take board policies for a minute, because, you know, many school districts have been around for decades, if not 100 years. And during that time, most school districts I'm aware of have very well articulated policies that cover any number of issues that could at some point be an issue for parents. In your experience, you have any maybe policy or two that you think parents could or should be better aware of for their child and the well-being of the child in that school as it relates to board policy?
Yeah, so it's interesting, because when we work with our clients, a lot of the questions I ask initially are, what does your board policy state? And I would say the same thing to parents, and now that I am a parent, you know, what does the board policy state about the particular issue you're looking at? And so on a couple of high-level points, I think it's important to understand the students' rights policies that are in place. So, for example, understanding what the school can and cannot do with respect to searches of individual backpacks, for example, is an important one for both parents and students to know. Another one for parents could be how are individual curriculums developed, and board policies regarding curriculums and whether or not your student or your child participates in reproductive planning classes, for example.
And any one of those could be a red-hot issue. Could you help our School Talks listeners understand, you know, all of us in the business know it as FERPA.
Correct.
Could you help them understand what FERPA is, what it means, especially what the acronym stands for, and how that plays into ultimately protections for a student?
So it stands for the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act, and it's a federal law that protects information about your student, and specifically, or your child, and specifically information that is written, in written form. And so when we talk about a report card, that is information that is protected by FERPA. It cannot be released to a third party by a school district. Conversely, there is some information that is allowed to be released to a third party by a school district if a parent does not specifically opt out. So, for example, directory information, so your student's name or what grade they're in or what your address may be, potentially can be released to a third party. And knowing what your district's policy states about that is important if you do not want that information released.
Sure, and there are a few exemptions to that release. Like, I remember, I think it was after 9/11, there are some exemptions where schools can release directory information to armed forces recruiters. Is that correct?
Correct.
Is that law still in place?
It is, yes.
Yeah. So there are exceptions to that. So when you look through the lens of board policy, and we're with right now John Cava, attorney at Collins & Blaha, talking about information available for parents. When you look at the big bucket of board policy, how does that translate into what would become a handbook that you actually give a parent? Because in my time, we never gave out copies of the policy. We always made it available on the website, but a lot of school districts actually produce a handbook. And what are some of the key things that schools put in the handbook that parents should be aware of?
So you're going to have annual notices that are going to be included in handbooks. So going back to the FERPA example, board policy will have broad picture what FERPA actually says. But then the student handbook will actually provide information to parents about, hey, if you want to opt out and not have your information released to a third party, you have to do it by August 1st, for example. So that notice will be in that handbook. There'll also be details, for example, about what the dress code is and what the specific procedures are with respect to student discipline. And if your student is going to be receive detention, what are the procedures to go through in order for that to actually be effectuated by a school?
And those handbooks can actually be the administrative guidelines side of policy that can change from year to year based on any current or existing condition that may have changed. Is that a fair assessment?
Correct. So the board policy is set by the Board of Education and needs to be adopted by the board, and then if any changes are made, the board makes those. But within that realm, with a student handbook or administrative guidelines, the administration of the district has the right to promulgate rules that are subject to board policy, but we'll go into more detail.
You know, I remember a time when I was a high school assistant principal, we would publish a handbook every year, and it was literally a cat and mouse game of what is the latest toy kids are using that is a distraction. Well, one were the fidget spinners, then laser pointers, then somehow the thong flip-flops made a recurrence in our shoe culture. And every year we got into this position of, well, we have to adjust the handbook because now laser pointers are popular.
Correct.
And it became this list of, if you didn't have it in your handbook, well... So we, through the advice of some good counsel, said you need to remove all that and say if the principal thinks it's disruptive, it's not allowed. And that certainly sort of changed the whole landscape of us having to chase down whatever the soup of the day is for kids. Let me ask you, are you currently dealing with any school districts right now and that are attempting to ban cell phones?
Yeah, so they're, you know, right now, when you talk about the soup of the day, it is talking about banning cell phones. You know, several years ago, it was how can we use cell phones and allow them in a manner to educate our students? And you know, the pendulum has swung back, so to speak. So yes, that is taking place.
And I think we all know, listeners as well as you and me, the effect and the force of social media has, in many respects, disrupted, if not destroyed, that opportunity for cell phones to be a resource, given how distracting it is. A couple of final thoughts. Any particular advice for parents on what they should be aware of as it relates to information from the school district?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is making sure that they are aware that there is information on whatever district they're in. There's going to be information available on their district's website. And typically that's going to be under some sort of parent resource tab. And that'll then include information related to laws that govern special ed, how you can go about requesting special ed services for your student or other services under a Section 504 plan, for example. And there'll also be information regarding what their constitutional rights are. So First Amendment rights and what speech they are allowed to participate in at school and what they're not allowed to participate. And there may be information about social media. You mentioned that. And even if you're engaging in social media off of school grounds, if it causes a disruption within the school grounds, there may be disciplinary action for that. And so there's a lot of information on those websites and with the Michigan Department of Education as well that provide those resources for parents.
Yeah. John Cava, attorney here at Collins and Blaha, you have given our School Talks listeners, especially our parents, some valuable information on what is available for them and, more importantly, what they should be aware of when they send their children to a public school. I appreciate your time today and keep up the good work.
Thank you. Appreciate the time.
As we close out today's program, I'd like to extend a sincere thanks to attorneys Gary Collins and Bill Blaha for not only being a primary sponsor of School Talks, but inviting us to their offices to hear from their great staff here on a number of education-related topics. That's all the time we have for now, but remember, there are two ways to spell one and three ways to spell two. Till next time, this has been School Talks on 760 WJR.